Greetings. This is Jeff Weverson, and you're listening to On the Brink with me. That's Jeff Weverson. This is the second installment of my show here on UCY-TV Internet Radio. Hope everybody's doing okay this evening or this afternoon here down under. Just wanted to let everybody know that, as far as I know, the universe and planet Earth does still exist. It's not a dream, or maybe it is, but the world hasn't come to an end yet. We've still got a couple of weeks until 21st of December, 2012. In another show, I'd like to talk about the whole idea of calendrical relativity and how many different cultures and peoples have perceived time. Very interesting thing to think about, because our perception and experience of time is intimately bound up with our overall worldview, which is in itself a large part a function of the language that we speak. English, being an Western Indo-European language, has its own sort of characteristics. It's a symbolic language as opposed to a harmonic language, which I'll talk about at another time. But it's very interesting to think about how our notions of time are intimately bound up with the way that we structure reality by means of our language. We've got past, present, and future. Benjamin Lee Whorf, who lived with the Hopi Indians in Arizona back in the 1940s, observed that their language has no tenses, and that they seem to live their lives in reality and shared experience in a dimension of an eternal now. Everything is now. So that alone is really hard for English-speaking people to get their heads around. But for today's show, we won't talk about calendrical relativity yet. I'll save that maybe for next week, as December 21st gets closer. What I'm going to do in this show is read a couple of chapters or portions of chapters from a couple of minds and authors who I think have made very great contributions to human understanding of issues that are of extreme importance that relate to being here now as human beings. The first author I'm going to read, his name is Jerry Mander. He was an advertising person in San Francisco who sort of saw the light in a similar way that Dr. Seuss was an advertising artist, and then he saw the light. He realized the damage that was being done to the minds of young people, especially through advertising. So he started writing and doing the artwork for his brilliant series of children's books. Dr. Seuss lived in La Jolla, California. Jerry Mander is from the Bay Area, and so he got out of advertising, and his first book is called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, which is probably the single best book about the dangers of television, and it's an extremely in-depth book. It covers everything from the neurophysiology to the electronic technology. It talks all about the techniques and paradigms of its use as a weapon, an instrument of propaganda and advertising. He talks about the whole nature of living in an artificially generated synthetic environment, the nature of language and linguistic communication. It's an excellent, excellent book. What I'm going to read from now is his next book. It's called In the Absence of the Sacred, and the subtitle is The Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indian Nations. And the chapter I'm going to read is about computers. It's called Seven Negative Points About Computers. But it's under part two, The Inevitable Direction of Megatechnology. And then if I have time, I'm going to read part of a chapter from Emmanuel Velikovsky's book called Earth in Upheaval, which is from, let's see, what year is that from? 1955. Velikovsky was a psychoanalyst who was originally a student of Sigmund Freud. He branched off, started doing his own thing, and became an outspoken scholar of the ancient world, but also an interdisciplinary synthesist in the sense that his mind ranged over the whole field of science, and he observed some interesting things. He observed that you can hear the kookaburras in the background singing here. It's early in the morning. There's the cockatoos flying over. Velikovsky observed that humanity seemed to be acting like, as a whole, our psychology was that of a traumatized psychiatric patient. And he started trying to figure out why. And he concluded that throughout the history of humanity on this planet, our ancestors have been repeatedly traumatized by catastrophic events and disasters, most of them of extraterrestrial origin, that created conditions so difficult for life on Earth that the people didn't know if they were going to survive or not. Like, for example, an asteroid collision or the Earth passing through the tail of a comet, perhaps intense radiation bombardment from a supernova or combinations of all of these things, catastrophic events arising from within the Earth itself in response to these things. And so he started exploring this, and he approached it in two ways. He first studied all the ancient literature of all the peoples that he could find, and found that there's these recurring themes in the literature of just about, or the oral histories of just about every culture that exists, and these pertain to these catastrophic events, many of which were floods. There seems to be the story of a great flood in the ancient history of just about every people that's existed. And he started realizing that these stories must be based on something that really happened. So, and then his other approach was studying the non-human or geological evidence from studying rocks and the remains of animals that have been found in weird places and sort of piecing together a state-of-the-art picture based on the leading minds of his day, the geologists and other thinkers. And so in this book, he examines the geological evidence, and the part of the chapter I'm going to read is called Cataclysmic Evolution. Okay, here we go with The Inevitable Direction of Megatechnology from In the Absence of the Sacred by Gerrymander, Sierra Club Books, 1992. Our assumption of technology's beneficence, combined with our passivity to its advance, has permitted certain technological forms to expand their scale of impact and to interlock and merge with one another. Together, they are forming something new, almost as if they were living cells. They are becoming a single technical economic web encircling the planet, megatechnology. Among the key components of this invisible apparatus are computers, television, satellites, corporations, and banks. Space technology, genetics, and the alarming new post-biological machinery, nanotechnology, and robotics. Holistic critiques reveal the role of each in the big picture, as well as the inevitable direction of the whole process. Chapter 4, 7 Negative Points About Computers. Without computers, the megatechnological age simply would not happen. Computers are basic to every new technical innovation, whether in communications, the military, genetics, transportation, automation, or multinational corporate activity. Because of this universality of applications and implications, computers have been celebrated more than any technology since electricity. Educators, corporate leaders, presidential candidates, futurists, and the media sing a unified chorus of praise. The situation is ludicrous. Computer technology has sprung us headlong into an entirely new existence, one that will permanently affect our lives and the lives of our children and grandchildren. It will speed up profound changes on the planet, yet there is no meaningful debate about it, no ferment, no critical analysis of the consequences. As usual, the major beneficiaries are permitted to define the parameters of our understanding. During 1988 alone, the microcomputer industry spent more than $1 billion in advertising, most of it on television. You have only to watch your TV tonight to be repeatedly told that neither you, nor business, nor your child can survive the future without computers. These messages from the microcomputer industry are in addition to those from other industries in praise of computers. Auto commercials promote their computerized features. Military recruitment ads trumpet the high technology training the military offers. High technology is taking over the world. Keep up with it or be left behind. Be all you can be. Join the army. And if anyone failed to get the high-tech message from the ads, TV news images of the Iraq-US war left no doubt about the glamour of computerized weaponry. Watches, telephones, stereo equipment, and instruments of all kinds boast of their digital operation. I know one chief executive of a wilderness travel company who advertises the company's data bank of wilderness experiences. Even environmentalists have failed to maintain the usual skepticism about corporate claims, accepting the apparent short-term benefits of computers without grasping that computers actually steer society in a direction that contradicts environmental goals. And writers, I must have been asked 24 times how I can say that computers are negative when they are so useful to writers. They save time and drudgery, they rearrange, they spell, they sort information, and you can play some fun video games with them too. But are any of those features really the point? Unfortunately, the major question about computers is not whether they serve you or your organization or your business well. I wish it were so simple to just take this personal view. We must look at the totality of how computers affect society and life on Earth. We need to dredge each dimension of their impact and put it all together into one picture before we can judge their existence as beneficial or harmful. This chapter, therefore, is an attempt at a holistic analysis of computers divided into 7 categories. 1. Pollution and health. 2. Employment. 3. Quantification and conceptual change. 4. Surveillance. 5. The rate of acceleration. 6. Centralization. And 7. The worst case scenario. Automatic computer warfare. And this is Jeff speaking. I would put in a footnote there. In the age of Brzezinski and technotronic weapons and HARP, the reliance and utilization of extremely advanced networks of computers is all the more important because that's who's running this whole technotronic warfare show. I believe that the whole system of these weapons are being operated as one integrated system, a planet-wide network of microwave transmitters that are all operating in sync together, operated by computers to do what Rosalie Bertel calls using planet Earth as the latest weapon of war. Section 1, pollution and health. Since its birth, the microelectronics industry has enjoyed a reputation as something apart from, better than, and cleaner than the old smokestack industries. Maybe this reputation goes with the neat design of the computers themselves, or maybe it's that the primary product is information rather than turbines or ball bearings. Perhaps it's the kind of people drawn to high-tech management who reflect a new-age, can-do, cutting-edge self-confidence, who exude the idea that we are the future. Or maybe, as my friend Ellen Weiss of the Museum of Modern Mythology believes, it's the silence of the computers that sustains this squeaky clean image. Everything seems to happen by magic, says Ellen. No moving parts. Anyway, this reputation is not deserved. Computers are not the free lunch they were promised to be. Health and environmental problems are visible in the communities in which the machines are built, among the workers who build them, and among the people who use them on the job. Computer manufacturing employs millions of gallons of acids and solvents that are eventually disposed of at toxic dumps. In communities where computers are manufactured, serious problems have arisen. In Silicon Valley, California, for example, high concentrations of trichloroethylene, a solvent that the EPA has called carcinogenic, have seeped into the drinking water. At one point, computer manufacturers, while not admitting guilt, passed out truckloads of bottled water in the affected communities. The EPA has identified 80 similar chemical spill sites associated with computer manufacturing and expects the problems to escalate. Suburban communities affected by toxic waste have been able to organize to mitigate the problems, but workers who manufacture computers and who have suffered health problems have been less effective. This is because most computer factory workers are non-union and many are non-English speaking and undocumented. so they have a hard time telling their story to management and or the press. Lately, however, workers have succeeded in publicizing high rates of miscarriages and reproductive disorders, as well as hair loss, chronic asthma, and other conditions apparently resulting from exposure to toxic chemicals and gases involved in manufacturing. Perhaps the most significant health problems associated with computers concern their use in the home or the office. If growing suspicions about the medical effects of computers are verified, tens of millions of people could be affected, and the orderly march of computers into every nook of American commercial and personal life will be slowed considerably. There have been medical reports for many years about complaints such as fatigue, eye strain, migraines, cataracts, and among pregnant women who use VDTs, video display terminals, miscarriages, birth defects, premature births, and infant deaths. At first, it was not believed that computers could have such effects. Recent research, however, has concentrated on computer-related radiation. VDTs generate a range of electromagnetic radiation from X-ray, ultraviolet, and infrared to low-frequency LF, very low-frequency VLF, and extra-low-frequency ELF wavelengths. At one time, it was believed that these low-frequency radiations were incapable of causing harm to human beings, but it has now been shown that people are far more sensitive to any radiation than previously believed, and that causal relationships are beginning to emerge. A large medical literature has now developed in the field, to which, unfortunately, I cannot give justice in these pages. For a very thorough overview, however, I refer you to Paul Brodeur's brilliant three-part series, The Annals of Radiation, in the June 1989 New Yorker, or his book, Currents of Death. Meanwhile, I will say this. The idea that computers are cleaner than other industrial products is wrong and dangerous. Just as this book goes to press, the city of San Francisco has become the first to acknowledge this fact by creating some minimal standards for safer use of VDTs in the workplace. Hopefully others will follow with more comprehensive rules. But such new standards notwithstanding, if I were a woman contemplating having children, I would not work at a computer terminal. Section 2. Employment. At the 1940 World's Fair, American industry promised that computers and automation would eliminate toil and thus free us to pursue higher goals. In the 1980s, industry said computers would open new careers and new kinds of industry and would ease the burden of office workers. In reality, these claims are just advertising pitches attuned to the popular concerns of the moment. What automation and computerization actually do achieve is the elimination of jobs, which liberates human beings to stand in unemployment lines. The utopian vision of a work-free society in which machines do most of the work while all the humans relax could only be realized if the economic benefits of automation and computerization were somehow shared by the workers. It would take a revolution to make this happen. For in capitalist society, the benefits are disproportionately allotted to the people who own the machines. Computers allow them to get the same job done with fewer pesky humans demanding increased wages, job safety, and health insurance. As my friend Jack Edelson, who runs a small manufacturing business in San Francisco, told me, "The worst thing about computers is that they are eliminating the middle class. Blue-collar workers are losing their jobs to robots. They can't afford to buy houses anymore. And we're soon going to be a country with more rich people and a lot more poor people. Big industry says automation is going to create jobs, but that's baloney. There are new jobs around, but they're at McDonald's at minimum wage. As for easing the burden for office workers, that is hardly an open and shut case. Computers have eased the burden for managers because the technology facilitates a level of the on-the-job surveillance that makes personal observation virtually unnecessary. A friend of my son, Kai, works as a 411 information operator for Pacific Bell. He told me about the experience. The computer knows everything. It records the minute I punch in, knows how long I take for each call. It knows how many calls I can handle per hour, how long I take on my break, and exactly when I leave. I'm supposed to average under 18 seconds per call and achieve a certain number of calls per day. Everything I do is reported to my supervisor on his computer, and if I've missed my numbers, I get a written warning. I rarely see the guy. I'm not allowed to be 1 minute late for work, ever, or to take longer than exactly 15 minutes for coffee. It's intense. It's me and the computer all day long. I'm telling you, at the end of the day, I'm wiped out. Working with computers is the coal mining of the 90s. Diana Roos, who is research director of the National Association of Working Women, told me, since the introduction of the computer into our office work, job design for secretaries has changed in negative ways. The typing part gets easier, but workers hate many aspects of these machines. For the first time, secretaries have to deal with production quotas. Performance on the job is evaluated much more in strictly objective terms. It used to be that an office worker would also be evaluated for her personal human contribution of energy and ideas. Now there is hardly any variety in office work. The jobs are dead-ended, and because the human connection is eliminated, jobs are less secure. Some people are calling office work the electronic assembly line. Cockatoos are flying past. Section 3. Quantification and conceptual change. The July 1984 issue of New Age Journal featured a story by R.H. Ring called The Computerized Forest, which lamented the conceptual changes among U.S. Forest Service workers who are now asked to do their job mainly via computers. The entire forest system, says Ring, has been divided into management units containing habitat capacity models and maximum sustainable yield computations, all of which reduce the need of species and the workers' understanding of them to quantified formulas. Computers were introduced into forest management like everywhere else for the sake of efficiency, the implication being that this would help preserve nature. In fact, the objective was to more efficiently account for forest resources, trees, animals, water, minerals, and to better develop them as part of commodity society. A former head of the Forest Service, John Crowell, who also formerly worked for Louisiana Pacific, said candidly that he favored thinking of the natural world in terms of commodities rather than amenities. So now the Flathead Forest in Montana has a planned output of 200 grizzly bears, and old-growth forest is called accumulated capital. As Ring wrote, the ecosystem is not so easily reduced to computerized bites. The needs of most wildlife species, their interrelationships and dependencies on their forest habitats, are not completely understood. It ought to go without saying that certain elements of forest resist objectification. The unnameable feelings and moods, the subtle relationships. At one time, according to Ring, forest managers learned these more subtle dimensions of forest life by direct experience, by physically being out in the woods, and they integrated what they learned into their planning. But as management goals changed from preservation to development, the tools changed as well, and with those tools changed the concepts and the job. Ring reports that now Forest Service workers themselves are changing. The new breed does not come to the task with a basic loyalty to and personal involvement with the land. They are more concerned with production goals and budgets. Of course, computers cannot be blamed for this change in direction for forest management, but they have made possible a new information system and an accelerated pace of development which accommodates the desires of the prime movers in our society. Meanwhile, with nuances, moods, and personal observations subtracted from the information model, the very elements by which humans and nature have traditionally communicated with one another, the end result is passionlessness, a net loss in intimacy with, caring for, and love of nature. Workers who are not comfortable with this new mode of reckoning leave the service and are replaced with workers who don't mind the change. The government of Canada has been as aggressive as the United States in introducing quantified computerized resource management. At a recent conference of circumpolar peoples, Inuit and Indians of the far north, the Canadian government announced a new initiative for bringing computers and computer training to native resource managers. The intention was ostensibly to be helpful, but the net result will be to destroy traditional resource management systems, and perhaps along with that, native resistance to large-scale exploitation. The assumption is that objective data of the sort that computers emphasize will improve upon methods natives have employed for millennia. Computers are actually antithetical to information sources that traditional societies have used. Personal observation, sensory interaction, historical and geographic contexts, and teaching about the human-wildlife relationship that have been passed down from previous generations. These sources offer a broader spectrum than mere numerical data, and recent studies have shown them to be just as effective. The viability of native economic practices will be discussed at length in Chapter 14, but I want to suggest here what will be lost if computers take over the management of native people's resources. Those are not computerized cockatoos, those are real, and there's thousands of them out there. Section 4, Surveillance. In terms of everyday life, the greatest danger of computers may be the level of surveillance they make possible. Computers have enabled the major institutions of our society, corporations, government agencies, the police, the military, to keep records well beyond what was previously possible. New York Times reporter David Burnham's splendid book, The Rise of the Computer State, covers this subject so thoroughly that I will devote only a few paragraphs here to summarizing it. Burnham offers the example of TRW Corporation, which holds in its computers the credit records of 120 million Americans. These reveal where you bank, how much money you have, what your income is, how much you owe, what you own, where you shop, how much you spend, who your dependents are, whether or not you have a criminal record, how well you pay bills, where you work and live, your telephone number, your social security number, and names of the rest of your family. The Medical Information Bureau has files on about 20 million people. Metro Mail, a direct mail ad agency, has files on about 74 million Americans. AT&T has a comparable number. Burnham acknowledges that the quantity of contemporary record keeping could have been managed before the invention of computers, but as a practical matter, it would have been absurd to attempt it. The collection process would have taken many times longer than it does now, and once collected, information retrieval would be extremely difficult since it would involve an incredible amount of manual searching. Computerization has now greatly reduced the economic disincentive to gather and inspect the files, says Burnham, so now the data is gathered. The federal government is not to be outdone by the private sector. Every year, government officials collect about 4 billion separate records about the people of the United States, an average of 17 records per person. Most of these files are held by the FBI, CIA, and NSA, which share interlocking networks with local police and private security agencies. You and your organization are surely included. What's more, only one or two remaining laws restrict these police and government agency networks from interlocking their data with your Social Security file, your phone number, your zip code, your IRS records, your employer, your bank accounts, your insurance, and all the private records that are now held by corporations. And soon the interlock will be able to include your own dear home computer, the one that makes you free. Thus far, civil libertarians have held the line against meshing all these identification systems into one omniscient central computer file, but these are the years of people that people get elected president for trashing the ACLU. Section 5, the rate of acceleration. In recent years, there has been resistance to the idea that bigger is necessarily better. People like Leopold Kerr and E.F. Shoemaker, as well as movements like the Greens and bioregionalism, have argued that the sheer size and scale of the economies and technologies of modern countries create insurmountable organizational problems and lead to alienation among people, hostilities among countries, and destruction of the environment. But if small is beautiful, as the cry goes, what about slow? Few people have noted that speed is an important dimension of scale. Today's largest institutions, the military, corporations, governments, banks, can only be as large and as globally far-reaching as they are able to quickly communicate mind-boggling amounts of data among their diverse branches. Computers, combined with satellite telecommunications, have shattered the now obsolete physical limits of size. An institution can now spread itself outward to encompass the entire planet. National boundaries are anomalies. As computers have accelerated and geographically broadened the information cycle within large institutions, human beings have had to move quickly to keep up. And as institutions and people have sped up economic activity, satellite mapping of resources, entry into previously untouched areas, instantaneous movements of funds, development of infrastructures, the face of the planet has been changing more rapidly than ever before. Corporate activity accelerates, impact on the planet accelerates, and human activity does as well. Is this good? In our society, speed is celebrated as if it were a virtue in itself. And yet, as far as most human beings are concerned, the acceleration of the information cycle has only inundated us with an unprecedented amount of data, most of which is unusable in any practical sense. The true result has been an increase in human anxiety as we try to keep up with the growing stream of information. Our nervous systems experience the acceleration more than our intellects do. It's as if we were all caught at a socially approved video game where the information on the screen comes faster and faster as we try earnestly to keep up. Video games are in fact a great example of this. They are often defended with such claims as they speed up hand-eye coordination. Commercial video game parlors effectively claim this when defending against parents groups that seek to ban them from a neighborhood. But why is this good to speed up hand-eye coordination? The only real benefit would be to improve one's basketball skills or to prepare for the next sped-up video game. Ronald Reagan praised video games as good training for the new generation of bomber pilots, who, like those who flew in Iraq, whose instruments resemble video games. For 400,000 generations, human hand-eye coordination was attuned to an environment operating at what you might call natural speed. Everything that human beings had to deal with moved at speeds appropriate to our abilities. It had to be that way in order for our species to survive. Species need to keep up with the tasks at hand. With the Industrial Revolution, many things began moving at mechanical speeds. As the natural environment was paved over, and as human life moved into human-made environments, the natural rhythms of our reactions gave way to industrial rhythms. We learned to interact with mechanical speeds, as assembly line workers and most auto drivers know. Now that machines move at electronic speeds, the wheel of activity turns even faster, with us on it. Computer video games are a good training for the faster world. When we play a video game, our goal is to merge with a computer program. The electronic symbols on the screen enter our brain, pass through our nervous system, and stimulate the fight-or-flight reaction that still lives within us and that expresses itself here through our hands. Very little thinking is needed or used. The object is to respond without thought instantly. Video games and computers accelerate a process that had already been stimulated by a generation of television viewing. Most people think of TV viewing as passive, which it is, while video games and computers are interactive. But the hyperactivity of TV imagery, while pacifying the brain, simultaneously speeds up the nervous system. TV makes us both dumb and speedy. In the end, television viewing just prepares us for the appropriate mental state for video games and computer fixation. And together, the technologies combine to produce a generation of people too sped up to attune themselves to slower, natural primordial rhythms. Video games, television, computers, Walkmans, kids carrying those big radios down the street, and the street, and the assembly line, and the freeway, they are all part of an acceleration process that spins our lives faster and faster, making it seem more exciting when actually it is only hyperactive. The prevailing paradigm that speed is inherently good benefits some elements of society more than it does others. Those who benefit most are the largest institutions, which can translate speed of transactions and travel directly into money and power. For most of the rest of the world, the emphasis on acceleration is harmful. It is surely harmful for workers. It is harmful for relationships among people. It creates anxiety. And it has very important ramifications for the survival of diverse non-Western cultures. Indigenous peoples tend to operate in small-scale economic communities by collective processes with all decisions made by consensus. This presupposes a high degree of intimacy among the people of the community. Since time is one of the several luxuries that indigenous peoples enjoy more readily than we do, communications are often characterized by deliberate slowness. People are not in a hurry. They don't believe in accomplishing more in less time because there is sufficient time to accomplish what needs to be done. They revel in the personal engagement that not rushing allows. When things do have to get done, they get done by the group acting in concert. In the past as in the present, the push of Western invading cultures has been to organize life along entirely different lines, clock time, schedules, goals, in order to increase surplus production. This in itself threatens the survival of non-Western culture since it changes the people and their traditional institutions. Section 6. Centralization. I recently attended a national bioregional congress, 250 people working toward the disintegration of central political power in favor of local control, economic self-sufficiency, and small-scale nature-based principles, green principles. Several participants publicly advocated a role for computers in building networks among the bioregions, thereby facilitating rapid exchanges of information. Although it was acknowledged this might create some centralization, it was also argued that computers are a neutral tool that could help groups whose goals are anathema to the large institutions that invented them and that dominate their application. This is a hot idea.
We take their invention and use a kind of jujitsu to turn it against its creators. Tempting, but it fails to reckon with the intrinsic aspect of computers that will inevitably result in centralization. The issue is confused at the outset by the fact that computers have the look of a small-scale democratic technology. People have them at home and find them empowering for themselves and their organizations. They are helpful in many ways and offer considerable personal control, unlike non-yielding technologies like television. Small social and political groups find computers valuable for information storage, networking, processing, mailing lists, preparing clean copy, maintaining membership lists, keeping accounts, and so on. Yet all this begs the question. The real issue is not whether computers can benefit you or your group. The question is who benefits most from the existence of computers in society. The answer suggests that for all of their small-scale benefits, the largest institutions have far more to gain, and they know it. The computer invasion was not engineered by a group of high-minded technological do-gooders determined to further democracy. Though computers were invented in the 1920s, it was the American and British military that first put them to serious use as guidance systems for missiles during World War II. Two decades later, IBM converted the technology to big business uses. It wasn't until the 1970s that Atari and Apple launched the campaigns to put a computer in every home and schoolroom. Do-gooders didn't hit a plastic key until the mid-1970s, when the military and the large corporations had already integrated them deeply into their operations with great benefit and greater geographical reach for centralized operations. Computer technology is an intrinsic part of an advanced technical infrastructure. Computers could only have emerged from a society already very far down a technical pathway. They are very costly to manufacture, they are intricately connected to centralized telephone systems, and some of them, their optimum uses, such as high-speed computation and satellite mapping of resources, are so costly that they are only available to the largest institutions. Computers serve the economies of scale in the same way as other recently developed technologies such as satellite communications, mechanical agriculture, robotics, pesticides. The larger an enterprise, the more computers it can afford. What's more, the computers will be more sophisticated, operated by better trained staff, and have more interfacings among widely dispersed regions than in smaller institutions. As a result, larger businesses gain a comparative advantage. Though small businesses benefit from using computers, larger institutions benefit far more since the scale and complexity and reach of operations that computers facilitate require much greater financial resources. Smaller businesses would actually be better off if computers had not been invented, since they are essentially one more tool that large businesses can use better. Consider the role of computers for international banks and conglomerates, moving money instantaneously from one market to another, feeding development here and then there. The multinational institutions of today could simply not operate as they do without computers and a satellite link-up. Computers have enabled these institutions to suddenly expand into a dimension never before possible. They are beyond multinational now, they are truly global. The accelerated pace at which forests are felled in Indonesia and Borneo, oceans are mined in the Pacific, and dams are built throughout the world reflects the increased ability of corporations to operate from a central management and still influence daily activities in all corners of the planet. It is profoundly naive for people who work to prevent planetary devastation to speak of the computer as if it were neutral, as if it were as useful for decentralization as it is to centralize development interests. Large institutions that seek the latter benefit far more than the do-gooders who plan to use computers for a high-tech jujitsu. It is only misunderstanding the big picture and a certain conceit that allows us to think any other way. Environmentalists, bioregionalists, and other progressive activists would be better off realizing that for all the little benefits they offer us, computers set our movements back. We ought to begin dealing with them as an urgent environmental and political issue in themselves. Part 7. Worst Case Scenario, Automatic Computer Warfare. It was possible to annihilate the world before the invention of computers, but it was far more difficult and much less likely. The invention of the computer instantly changed the speed at which war could be waged, the scale of its impact, and the quantity of destruction. Computer technology has already produced an unprecedented degree of military centralization. Generals sitting in an underground war room somewhere outside Washington can, in one moment, observe the position and readiness of all U.S. military hardware and a high percentage of Soviet hardware around the globe. Soviet generals outside Moscow can do likewise. From Military Central, it is also possible to fire missiles and track their progress via computerized displays, not unlike those depicted in films like War Games. In fact, managing warfare now resembles playing a giant video game, following electronic blips on a massive screen, abstract, cerebral, removed from direct involvement. One could argue that this manner of waging war makes war more likely, since it separates humans from the consequences of their actions, unlike ground action, where you put bayonets through people's bodies and watch them bleed. When enemy forces are reduced to blips on a video screen, impossible to verify by direct observation, there is a far greater chance of error. In one 18-month period ending June 30, 1980, U.S. strategic forces experienced 151 false alarms, five of which were significant enough to put our forces on alert status. In several of these cases, the alert was in response to flights of birds. In one case, it was the rising moon. This problem of computer error in a military context is one of the main concerns of Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, a group of Silicon Valley corporate executives, programmers, and engineers who are concerned about the military potentials of computers. According to CPSR, in all but the simplest computer programs, hidden design flaws can persist, sometimes for years, even though the system appears to work perfectly. There exist no known methods for eliminating this uncertainty in complex computer programs. No amount of testing under simulated conditions can replace the testing that comes from embedding the system in the actual environment for which it was designed, in this case, nuclear war. But all experience with complex computer systems indicates that it is the circumstances that we totally fail to anticipate that cause the serious problems. CPSR argues that computer error can only be mitigated by human intervention. What makes the current military-computer collaboration so terrifying is that the computers have reduced the time available for decision-making to the point where it is now virtually automatic. Humans are nearly out of the loop. Can we blame computers? The big question is this: is it fair to blame computers for any or all of the above scenarios? Most people, even those who see the relationship between computers and increased destructive potential, consider the computer themselves to be harmless, value-free, neutral. People invent the machines is the common wisdom. People program them. People push the buttons. And yet, it is a simple fact that if there were no computers, the process of engaging in war would be much more drawn out, with a lot more time for human beings to change their minds or seek alternatives. It is only because computers do exist that a virtually automatic, instant worldwide war involving total annihilation even enters the realm of possibility. So can we say that computers are to blame? It is also a fact that if computers somehow totally disappeared, the world would be instantly safer. Even if atom bombs continued to exist, they would no longer have effective delivery systems. Pakistan could still drop an atomic bomb on India, but the presently envisioned all-out nuclear war, which could possibly extinguish the human species, would be impossible. I know that this is a difficult position to accept. Critics call it throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Just because computers are integral to modern systems of nuclear annihilation, does that mean we must rid ourselves of computers? I'm not sure, but I think so. This society upholds a fierce technological idealism. We believe we can get the best from a given technology without falling into worst-case scenarios of the sort described above. We maintain this idealism despite the fact that we have no evidence of technology ever being used at an optimal level or even being sensibly controlled. This is certainly true of automobiles, which have virtually destroyed the natural world, and of television, which creates a common mental denominator, and of electrical energy generation, which is vastly overdeveloped to the detriment of the planet. Most technologies are actually deployed in the manner that is most useful to the institutions that gain from their use. This may have nothing to do with public or planetary good. We are also influenced by the paradigm that technological evolution is a good thing, that no bounds should be put upon knowledge or possibility. Other societies have the concept of taboo to deal with destructive tendencies, but in our society, the idea of taboo is itself taboo. And as we have discussed, our society does not have mechanisms for evaluating the negative aspects of technology, so we bang ahead blindly, even in military development. The military-computer matchup is irresistible. For them, it is a match made in heaven. It is intrinsic to military thinking to seek the ability to act in more centralized, more complex, faster, more far-reaching, and more destructive ways. If you are a general whose task is fighting and winning wars, you love computers. No single technology has ever offered so much and in so many areas. The U.S. military continues to be the largest single financial source for computer science research in the world. The attraction between the military and the computer sciences has an almost gravitational pull. In fact, one could argue that the recent consumerization of the computer is merely a glamorization to help create public sympathy for its use as a panacea, when military use of computers is really the point. Of all possible beneficiaries, the military benefits most from computers. Computers mean more to the military than they will ever to you and me, or to educators, or even to corporations and banks, though they run a close second. And of all the world-altering implications of computers, the military-computer collaboration is the most potentially devastating. The possibility of computer-directed instantaneous worldwide holocaust is not theoretical. Every military in the world has attached itself to computers, and all military strategies are now computer-based. The programs are written, the computers are ready to act. In the face of this reality, to speak of computers helping you edit your copy or run your little business seems a little bit absurd. Now I'm going to read the section from Emanuel Velikovsky's book, Earth in Upheaval, called Cataclysmic Evolution. When, therefore, the earth, covered with mud from the recent flood, became heated up by the hot and genial rays of the sun, she brought forth innumerable forms of life, in part of ancient shapes, and in part creatures new and strange. From Ovid, Metamorphoses, translated by F.J. Miller. An enormous expansion of radioactivity in bygone ages was postulated by various theorists as an explanation of great oscillations in climate in the past. The thermal effect of widespread radioactivity is likewise claimed as a motive force by the author of the modern version of the theory of drifting continents, Du Toit. It appears to me that if such radioactivity really occurred, its mutation effect could not have failed to take place too. Cosmic rays or charges hitting nitrogen atoms in the atmosphere transform this element into radiocarbon. These charges arriving from outside the Earth are very strong per particle, averaging several billions of electron volts and sometimes carrying a potential of 100 billion electron volts. As comparatively few such rays or charges hit our atmosphere, their general effect is not spectacular. But it is conceivable that when a cosmic ray or charge hits a gene or of germ plasma, a biological mutation takes place comparable to the physical transmutation of the elements. After all, the genes, like any proteins, are biochemical compounds composed of carbon, nitrogen, and a few other elements. Should a somatic chromosome be hit by a powerful charge, it might at worst cause disorganized growth and be the origin of a neoplasma. But if the genes of the germ plasma should be the target of a collision with a cosmic ray or secondary radiation, a mutation in the progeny might ensue. And should many such hits occur, the origin of a new species, most probably incapable of individual or genetic life, but in some cases capable, could be expected. Thus, increased radioactivity coming from outside this planet or from the bowels of the Earth could be the cause of the spontaneous origin of new species. Should an interplanetary discharge take place between the Earth and another celestial body, such as a planet, a planetoid, a trail of meteorites, or a charged cloud of gases, with possibly billions of volts of potential difference in nuclear fission or fusion, the effect would be similar to that of an explosion of many hydrogen bombs, with ensuing procreation of monstrosities and growth anomalies on a large scale. What matters is that the principle that can cause the origin of species exists in nature. The irony lies in the circumstance that Darwin saw in catastrophism the chief adversary of his theory of the origin of species, being led by the conviction that new species could evolve as a result of competition, with accidental characteristics serving as weapons only if almost limitless time were at the disposal of that competition, with no catastrophes intervening. Now exactly the opposite is true. Competition cannot cause new species to evolve. Mutations in single traits and the resulting new varieties within a species are caused by radiation hitting some gene, as did the X-rays in the experiments on the vinegar fly. It is a hit or a collision or a miniature catastrophe. In order for a simultaneous mutation of many characteristics to occur, with a new species as a resultant, a radiation shower of terrestrial or extraterrestrial origin must take place. Therefore, we are led to the belief that evolution is a process initiated in catastrophes. Numerous catastrophes or bursts of effective radiation must have taken place in the geological past in order to change so radically the living forms on Earth as the record of fossils embedded in lava and sediment bears witness. How would this understanding of evolution meet the facts, and especially those facts that always appear to be in discord with the theory of natural selection? The fact that some organisms, like foraminifera, survived all geological ages without participating in evolution, a point of perplexity in the theory of natural selection, would be explained by catastrophic evolution in which many species would be destroyed, others would be subjected to multiple mutations, and some specimens of species would escape mutations and procreate their old form. The fact that the geological record shows a sudden emergence of many new forms at the beginning of each geological age does not require the artificial explanation that the records are always defective. The geological records truly reflect the changes in the animal and plant worlds from one period of geological time to the next. Many of the new species evolved in the wake of a global catastrophe at the beginning of a new age, were entombed in subsequent paroxysm of nature at the end of that age. The fact that in many cases the intermediary links between present-day species are missing, as well as those between various species of the geological record, a vexing problem, is understandable in the light of sudden and multiple variations that gave rise to new species. It was objected that if a new characteristic appeared in only a single animal, as the theory of natural selection claims, or even in a few animals of the same species, it would disappear in succeeding generations through interbreeding unless the new animal had been protected by isolation on secluded islands. However, in catastrophic evolution, the simultaneous mutation of many genes could produce a new species at the first fertilization. All the offspring of a litter could be affected similarly. And it is not inconceivable that in more than one creature of the same species, under similar circumstances of radiation, similar changes in the genes would occur. So in the X-ray experiments on Drosophila, similar mutations occurred in more than one fly. The objection to the theory of natural selection, that the developed plan in a new species must appear suddenly, or the race would expire, as in the case of the kangaroo pockets, is answerable within the framework of the catastrophic evolution. However, the purposefulness of animal structures will remain a problem deserving of as much wonder as, for instance, the purposeful behavior of leukocytes in the blood that rush to combat a noxious intruder. The fact stressed by Agassiz that numerous earlier species of fish showed a more highly developed organism when compared with later species of fish can be explained by the destruction of earlier forms, not in the process of competition, but in upheavals against which superior structure is no defense. The observation that healthy species of animals like mammoths with no sign of degeneration suddenly became extinct greatly troubled the evolutionists. This fact is explainable by natural selection or the principle of competition, not so by the catastrophic intervention of nature. The fact that at several stages of the past many animals of various species and many species in toto were rather suddenly exterminated in conflict with the idea of slow extinction and natural selection conforms with the theory of cataclysmic evolution. The enigmatic observation that the larger animals were particularly subject to extinction, the giant mammals that succumbed at the end of the tertiary, and again in the Pleistocene, as earlier the dinosaurs did, is comprehensible if one thinks of the better chances smaller animals have of finding refuge from the ravages of nature. The origin of new species from old could be caused by the processes that can be duplicated in laboratories. By excessive radiation or some other irritant in abnormal doses, thermal or chemical, all of which must have taken part in natural catastrophes of the past and could have played a role in building new species, as the case of new plants in the bomb craters appears to indicate. The theory of evolution is vindicated by catastrophic events in the Earth's past. The proclaimed enemy of this theory proved to be its only ally. The real enemy of the theory of evolution is the teaching of uniformity, or the non-occurrence of any extraordinary events in the past. This teaching, called by Darwin the mainstay of the theory of evolution, almost set the theory apart from reality. Great catastrophes of the past, accompanied by electrical discharges and followed by radioactivity, could have produced sudden and multiple mutations of the kind achieved today by experimenters, but on an immense scale. The past of mankind, and of the animal and plant kingdoms, too, must now be viewed in the light of the experience of Hiroshima and no longer from the portholes of the Beagle. the ship on which Charles Darwin, as a young naturalist, made his voyage around the globe.
It's very interesting to observe that Emanuel Wielkowski, in studying the writings and history of ancient civilizations, noted that the leaders or rulers of ancient kingdoms like Mesopotamia, Assyria, Babylon, that one of the highest goals professed by these rulers was their desire to emulate the gods. That's what Wielkowski said. These rulers wanted to emulate the gods, and by that, I think he meant that they to emulate the gods created bolts of lightning in the sky and caused massive havoc and destruction at a large-scale level, and made thunder and the ground shake and earthquakes and stuff. And so these rulers wanted to emulate the gods for some reason, and maybe it's because of the unconscious trauma that their ancestors had experienced for so long. They wanted to emulate those forces that had destroyed their ancestors and caused such suffering and fear. So my hypothesis is that that's what we're seeing in our world today, that we are attempting to emulate the gods through our most advanced forms of technology, beyond atomic weapons, and with the technotronic scenario now of generating earthquakes and chemtrails and weather modification and all kinds of weird stuff. We've got our most advanced technologies aimed at ourselves, and it seems like that we are trying to emulate the gods of destruction, and we don't really know why we're doing it. I think it's also a karmic consequence of the fact that we've been violating the earth, specifically digging precious things from the land for thousands of years in what we call civilization, which is really based on war against the earth. These are topics we'll talk about on more shows, but for now I'd like to thank you for listening to On the Brink with Jeff Wepperson. I'd like to thank Jules and all the people at UCY-TV, as well as Daniel and Christina, and I hope you guys have a really good week, and we have so much to be thankful for. We have beautiful Mothership Earth, our mother, and she loves us very much. Remember, live simply so that others may simply live.